This is Rosemary Slater, Real Six. Going back to the Wasbys, did you have much of a social life during your time?
Yes,
there?
I suppose we must have done, because there were so few girls that we were probably rather spoiled. Used to go and watch a lot of polo matches, and I had a very nice man who was very keen on me in the remount depot. So they had wonderful horses, as you can imagine. So he said, oh, you must ride. So he used to send round about 6 o'clock in the morning a horse with a sices, they called them. And off I used to go and ride, which was lovely around there, especially in the early mornings. And of course, Burma, not unlike Malaya, has a much more of a season. So it could be quite cool during the sort of winter season, as they would call it, I suppose. And then, of course, you've got the terribly hot time and the torrential rain, which I do remember. And everywhere we motored when the rain came was the roads not being tarmacked. You can imagine with the dust, you know, it was just absolutely mud. And we used to have these enormous tank transporters going along. We used to have to crawl behind, you can imagine, with either the dust or the mud. So we used to try and stop at any unit that was nearby till it had gone through and that kind of thing. No, I can't say we had... I suppose, of course, when we were out during the day to the units, we always lunched in the mess. So that was always very jolly. We'd finished our morning work, so we went back to the mess for lunch. And that was always jolly because everybody wanted to know this and chat and have drinks probably. And that was because by that time it was probably 2 or 3, so we finished for the day by the time we got back to our own village, as you might say. So there was that certain amount, but I can't remember any particular. We had one or two what I call nuisances. There was one particular man called, army chap called Timberlake. And when we were all sitting in the mess, probably tea or something, would say, oh my God, Timber. So we used to scatter, and the last one there had to entertain this terrible man called Timberlake. So, as I say, we used to shout, Timber, and scatter. But I can't think of anything particular in that way.
Would you have had dances, music?
Not very much there, no. I think in Rangoon you would have done, probably. But you see, Tongu, we were way out in the sticks. There was nothing like that. And apart from going to the odd mess for lunch, or perhaps dinner... there wasn't really very much happening. You know, great fun going to the polo matches and watching that. So, and I know we all went in a tank once and got terribly stuck down a hole. He was showing off, you know. We couldn't get out for a little while. But I can't think of any wild sort of parties, really.
Would the Wasbys generally have sort of interacted with the officers in the army rather than other ranks?
Yes, yes.
Would that have been the case?
Very much the case, I'm afraid.
Even Private Wasbys?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think, do you see, what you call again in Calcutta is where you noticed it, because there we were privates, we went to all the clubs, officers' clubs, which we wouldn't have done if we'd been WACIs, you know, the Indian equivalent of the army. Their privates weren't allowed, but I suppose we were rather like fannies, you see, that sort of level. I know, isn't it off to talk about that, but it's true, I'm afraid. It'd be very much the same background.
Mm. Were you all the same background?
Yes, very much, yes. You know, with families and abroad and that kind of thing. I can't really think of anybody. There were one or two, shall I say, what I call Australian lot were a little odd. Two I can think of. But then most of the ones I met were all the same sort of background. Probably been at school, at home, you know, and that kind of thing, like I was. But that was, I must admit, that was a distinction, and I did notice that in Calcutta and Bombay. You know, we always entered the clubs everywhere, and the chaps could take us in, you see. Well, they couldn't have taken the private in the Indian Army, so, and the Australian Army probably for that. No, no, we were very lowly there.
You were raised up by being
raised
a Wall Street.
Up, absolutely. Mm. So, but quite a different atmosphere, of course, to Norden. And I think, again, all being rather the same, we had quite a high code of, I know it's a stupid word, but behaviour. You see what I mean? And that probably stood us all in good stead. And also we were, you know, we were quite in awe of our, and if there'd been anything, we would have been out straight away, no nonsense about it, because Mrs. Ninian Taylor wouldn't have stood for anything. So that really, it was quite a high standard, shall I say.
Was there a difference between the ranks within the WASBs?
No. No. I mean, apart from, as I say, whoever was in charge of the canteen, naturally we went along with whatever she said. But there was no sort of rank pulling or anything like that, not at all.
And was there much emphasis on sort of spit and polish and discipline?
No. No. Because, I mean, they were pretty basic, these, where we were living, our billets were pretty basic. You were either in the tent or a bash or a broken down house somewhere. I think for our own living, we wanted it to make it as comfortable and tidy and as nice as we could. So from that angle, but there was no sort of standing and ceremony with our uniforms and everything. And the Dobie man would come and pick up our uniforms. At least we didn't have that washing to do that I had in Australia. So that was all done. And they would bring back all the stuff washed and everything.
And would you have had a lot of help with the canteens? You know, people to do washing up and cooking?
Not yes, in the static canteen, we did have help there, mostly Indians. We certainly had Indian cooks, do you see, that did that part. And on the hill, they did most of our cooking as well for the house, wherever we were, or the tents, or we had a mess tent, probably. But, yeah, I can't honestly say we were waited on, shall I say. No, we just had to get on with it ourselves. Apart from lovely having the laundry done, that was a great... But I must admit, probably the early girls probably had awful trouble in getting their laundry done because they were in sort of very much advanced areas. By the time I got there, it was much more, shall I say, civilized living because of that. Funny how it smells, you remember, like a cuticura talc powder. Stupid thing, but ever I smell that or something like it, it takes me straight back because we used to sell tins of this stuff.
Did anyone eat it?
No, not that. No, just the Brill cream. And I think we may have had Pond's cream too. Though I can't think why, because we can't have been much call for that. But I noticed in one of the books mentions Pond's cream, but our case it was definitely Brill cream that the chaps liked. And there were these delightful great big West Africans. They probably ate it and smeared it all over themselves, I should think. But what was nice, there was quite a lot of mixture of officers. I mean, you went to a Sikh regiment. There were a lot of Sikh officers and Rajputana regiments. Do you see, there were a lot of Indian officers. And so there was quite a mixture of messes, you know, with the Indian officers.
How about the West Africans? Were you ever with them?
No, but we did have one unit with us. But I don't remember any West African officers, funny enough. It was all British officers. But the West African troops were delightful. They were very easy and nice. Now, Peter Hopkirk, as a national service, I think he went out to West Africa and joined the West African Rifles for a time. Because I think Jan told me he's still in contact with them. And I think he contributed to the paper, which was called The Drum. That may ring a bell somewhere. I don't know all the details, I'm afraid, on that.
Was it meaningful for you to have been a WASB in the war?
I don't know why.
Three different sort of areas. Mm. Your Signal Corps and then the Australian Army.
I don't know, it's a silly word, but I think it was sort of more romantic or something. I think the sort of wildness of Burma and in many ways the beauty of the country was fascinating. And I loved going into, we had a market not very far from us, going into the market and chatting, I suppose. I don't suppose the language was there, but to the Burmese women. And the most lovely looking women, and yet there they were puffing away at cheroots, which of course was a great thing. So quite a lot of chaps used to buy these cheroots that smelt to high heaven. And our British other rank adored them, so he was always buying them. He was just, oh, Bill, put that out, the smell's awful.
Did you meet many of the tribes people, the different...
Not very much. There was one delightful Karen, where he was an officer, and, delightful chap who got married. So again, she must have been a Christian Burmese, because they were married in our local, what was left of a small church near us. I remember that. And I don't know who played the music or what it was, but we all sang Coming In on a Wing and a Prayer, and I've never forgotten. I couldn't quite see the sort of tie-up of that. But that was delightful. But no, not very many. Now, I did meet somebody very interesting, and she wrote a book, Ursula Graham Barr. Does that ring a bell with you? She was called Queen of the Nagas. And I've got her book somewhere. Now, Bill Betts, who she married. Now, Bill, I remember, was in Tongu, and he was passionate for butterflies and birds. And twice I remember going with Tim into the jungle to look for these special butterflies and birds and things. I mean, it was fascinating. And then out came this book, and she eventually marries Tim. He meets her somewhere. It's a delightful book, Queen of the Nagas. And Yes, and she did go right up. And I can't remember how she got there, but her book is delightful. And she lived amongst them for a time and got to know them very well. And I should think she must be one of the few people that did, because not many people got into those villages at all, you know. But I always wonder what happened to her eventually.
When did you start having your reunions with the WASBs?
Well, sadly, I couldn't go to the first one, which again shows it in the book. And that was in London, and I was away. I can't think where I could have been, but I know I couldn't go to it. So we haven't had very many, not very many. And it wasn't till VJ Day. Oh, I used to go to the odd Burma luncheon, and so there were WASBs there that came to that. But it really wasn't to VJ Day that I started going more regularly.
That would be the 50th anniversary, wouldn't
it? Yes, it would, yeah. And that's when, as I say, they marched round with the chaps. And then we had, that was the same year, we had this march to the cenotaph.
And were you in that?
Yes, was in that, and they relayed the reef. And we all managed to get green berries, and most of us had our chintzes, flashes, so we put those up. And I think we just wore dark clothes and had our berries and off we did. I must try and find that fit across.
I suspect you were able to march, given
I was the only one. Yes, the only one. The others rather sort of nonchalantly walked along, and I was probably the only one marching with the chaps in front, you know, you can imagine. And I think my sloop was probably the best of the lot.
Is your Australian army?
That's right, yes. I always wondered what the Duke of Kent took that salute. What he must have thought of this little rabble of women going by him.
Did you meet Nintendo after the war?
No, I didn't. I couldn't go to that meeting, sadly.
That was the last one.
That was the first one. And almost the first and the last, shall we say, to the VJ. And then they'd been going, I think, to the London, to the Burma Star reunion, which happens every year in London. And that's run by a delightful man called Neville Hogan, who is a Karen himself. And he wanted to go back to check up on the family. And, of course, as you know, they're very much at war with the Burmese government. And we paid for, we all contributed, and paid for him and his wife to go back via Thailand. And they got into Burma there, and he was able to meet up with some of the family, because on that Thai border, of course, the Burmese have not got the control of that, so they were able to meet up with the family and take money in and things. So that was nice, wasn't it? But, and of course I've got all Bernard Ferguson's books, and of course I knew quite a lot of them, because again they were, you know, with 19 Div and Lushai Scouts, and so quite a few of the names that come into his book I met afterwards. But, no, it's interesting what an impression it must have made on me. I don't know. Very much, again, part of my life. All in pockets. And then there's the same Malaya. No, it made a great impression on me, and I think I was very lucky to have been there. I was a very special unit, no doubt about it.
The Waspis.
Very.
And 19 Div.
And 19 Div,
yes. Yes. Did you get a feeling they were the Forgotten Army?
I don't think I realised then, because going straight to Malaya, I wouldn't have heard so much about it. If I'd come straight home to England, I would have probably realised it much more, because they would have been all talking about the European War. But you see, living out to Malaya, in my case, it was probably prisoners of war, so I was much more conscious of being our war, as you might say. While in England, I would then have realised that they were forgotten now, because nobody would have been talking about it. It wouldn't have come up. So, I don't know if that makes sense or not. I suppose it's true, though.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Rosemary, for telling me about your very fascinating war experiences.
I think it's gone on and on.
In three different units. In three different units. Thank you.
I think it's gone on and on.
Well, it's all very interesting. And this is really a PS, isn't it?
Mm.
But it would be very interesting to ask you about your time in Italy. Mm-hmm. Because you would have been there in the 1930s.
That's right,
and
yes.
Lake Como,
a place called Montrazio,
yes.
Which wasn't very far from Como itself, actually. So it was quite easy to get from Milan, I think. But this great aunt, she and her husband loved Lake Como, and they bought this derelict big palazzo called Passalacqua, which belonged, I believe, was built for one of the popes. I can't remember the dates or anything like that, but I know it was still part of their sort of domain from Rome, because there were quite a lot of stone bits and pieces were very much of Pontius, well, you know, very much of the popes, not like big cardinal hats and things like that, you know. And Auntie Bob then decided, because she was living in Italy, she became a Roman Catholic. And she had two sons, who were very naughty. And when we used to go to church, we had to go with Auntie Bob to the Roman Catholic one. And Peter used to call out, "Heretics to the left, Romans to the right." So they used to go off to the English church. And then we'd all meet up at this lovely little sort of coffee shop to have eclairs and things after church. But it was an incredible lifestyle because we lived at one end of this old house, and we had a lovely sort of dining room called the Sala di Stampa because it had great big painted ceilings and very much of that sort of type, typical Italian old houses. And we had that, and we had a very nice sitting room. But we weren't allowed to use the front stairs, so we always had to go up the back stairs. And then invariably we had to wear little black overalls. And then there was a funny little sort of lobby bit. And so we all had to meet for Auntie Bob. We had to be ready for Auntie Bob when she came down the stairs for lunch. So there we were, lined up, ready to say good morning, Auntie Bob, and good morning, Uncle Fit. And have our overalls taken off us, hair brushed, tidy. Then we would go into lunch. And we weren't allowed to say a word till we were spoken to, as you can imagine. And we had to eat everything, absolutely everything, which was absolutely purgatory. But now, of course, I can go anywhere. I can eat anything. It's quite true. All around the world, I've had no trouble eating anything.
Did Mussolini and the rise of fascism impinge on this at
not
all?
At that stage. Where we noticed it most was at school, because naturally all schools had to have a certain amount of that going on. So, as I say, we were all supposed to be young fascistas, and I think I even had probably a uniform at one stage with a little black cap with a pom-pom on it. And we used to sing the songs. I know we sang, I can't remember what they were now, but we used to have to sing these songs. But I don't honestly remember it being anything too terrible. I think, you see, the early 30s, it probably wasn't really as bad as it was later on, as you could imagine, because after all, it was very much the beginning of Mussolini's time. So it wasn't, it didn't really affect us terribly.
Did you hear of the name Mussolini?
Oh, yes.
Did it mean much?
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. And already by that time, the flags, you know, with the what you call, oh dear, the branches stuck together, you know, with the thing. But I can't honestly remember it being probably not like Germany, I don't think. Not at that stage. You see, by the time we left, probably I should think late 30s, things were getting much more under his thumb. But at the early 30s, I don't think it was. We used to go, Auntie used to take a house in Venice for 2 months in the summer. And so we all went practically. Half the household used to go, and they had their own motorboat and everything. And I got photographs of my grandmother, Auntie Bob, and everybody, of course, at the Lido, in their, you know, the beach pajamas. Remember, they all wore those. I can't believe it now. But that was absolutely idyllic. It was, we had a lovely time there.
Did your aunt survive the war in Italy?
Yes.
Although she was English.
Though she was English, I think I told you she had these three passports, but she seemed to manage to juggle. So when Russia was pro-Germany, she used the Russian one. She then had a Polish one, which wasn't quite, no, not the Polish one, it was the Swedish one she had, because her great-grandmother had been a Swede, and her name was von Sedelholm. And so Auntie Bob, being a terrible snob, in that line of the family, they were allowed to take on the Baroness part. So she always called herself the Baroness and was known as the Baroness. Well, Uncle Fit wasn't. He was just plain Mr. Norden.
So what was the other one? It was Russian and Swedish, and the other passport would have been British.
It would have been British, yes. But she still talked with a slight Scottish accent because she was also brought up in Italy, and there they'd gone to school in Germany at one time, because Auntie Bob could speak fluent Germany. German. She had a lot of German servants in the house in those days, and Italian, French, English. And I mean, her table, was a mixture of people. I mean, there were cardinals, I can't tell you, and the Hohenlohes, Princess Hohenlohe used to come, and of course counts and countesses put to a penny in it. Very much of that time.